Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
Even though you make payroll every Friday, you don't have a guaranteed paycheck. You're a small business owner, and you eat what you kill.
We're back. It's 13 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. If you'd like to join us, our phone number is 888-822-8255, 1-888-822-8255, and my website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. Don't forget to sign up for my newsletter when you get there. It's free. It comes out every weekend. I think you'll like it, and if you decide that you don't, it's even easier to unsubscribe. Let me tell you about our guest this hour. He's been with us before. Charles W. Cadillac is Managing Director of J&W Seligman and Company, Incorporated, and Chief Investment Strategist for Seligman Advisors, distributors of the Seligman Funds. They're based in New York City, and Chuck has had a long and varied career in finance, economics, and politics. He served as economic advisor to Jack Kemp in his U.S. presidential bid back in 88, I think it was. His articles are often seen in the Wall Street Journal. In fact, there was one recently, I think, back in the early part of this month in February. And he's got a new book out, been out a few months, called Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction, and he's our friend, Chuck Cadillac. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be back.
It's good to be back. Good to have you back on the show. And also, one of the things that Chuck does is he watches what the Fed does, and we're going to blend in some of the things that the Fed's been doing lately, the Federal Reserve Board, in our discussion. Chuck, when you were on last, you told us that you were working on a book, and you promised to come back and talk to us about it, and you've made good on your promise. The book is called Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction. Now, as the Dow is sitting at 10,000, how crazy is it to write a book called Dow 100,000?
Well, it's not crazy because we know it's possible. It's a tenfold increase from here. We've just lived through a tenfold increase in the Dow over the past 17 years, so we absolutely know it's possible. But many of us will remember that the prior 17 years, from 65 through 82, the Dow went nowhere, hence the question, fact or fiction. This is not a Pollyannish view of the future, but what it does claim is that prosperities and bull markets, rising stock markets, never, ever die of old age. They're always killed by a policy error. The three killers are tax increases, monetary instability, and trade restrictions. And when I look at the world and the historical forces that are in play today, it looks to me like, in fact, each of those three key signposts are moving in a positive direction, the kind of direction that would support prosperity. Tax rates, I believe, will be coming down in the United States. We've restored price stability, though we have a little bump in the road here. And finally, there's a consensus among the American people that we should be moving towards freer trade, or continue, actually, the movement towards free trade.
I agree with you. Now, one of the things that you want to make sure we state, and that you believe that we could achieve Dow 100,000 by the year 2020, is that right?
Yeah, 2020, it implies that the Dow would compound at 11.1% a year. Now, that's high. If the Dow is a price-only index, the S&P, a total return, it's a little arcane, but it's important. Mm-hmm. Now, the S&P, a total return, has been advancing at about 11.5% a year. So that wouldn't be extraordinary, but if you add in the dividends, if you take out the dividends, the compound return is more like 7% a year. So 11% a year is well above average. Nothing near like we've had for the last 3 or 4 years. That's an extraordinary rate of advance. So it's not unrealistic. It's definitely doable, but it requires us to avoid the kind of policy errors that have ended our prosperities in the past.
Well, notwithstanding the policy issues, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, the peace dividend is something you definitely mentioned in your book, and I think that's something, if we can maintain based what generally is basically, reasonably speaking, world peace, and the technology dividend. Don't you think that those two things, the advances in technology and hopefully continued world peace, will be two great contributors to reaching 100,000 in 20 years?
Yeah, absolutely, because each of those in its own right changes the background dynamic of the world political and economic structure. The end of the Cold War ends effectively 80 years of being in a state of emergency ever since World War I. We've been in an emergency with this brief respite called the Roaring Twenties, but we had the economic emergency of the 30s, World War II, the Cold War. During emergencies, it's natural for people to centralize power, to allow a few people to make decisions for all of us. For example, when Hurricane Floyd was hitting up the East Coast, a single man got on television, told people to board up their houses, get to higher ground. You know, like millions of people did exactly what he said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if that same person were to get on the radio or the television today and say the exact same words, people would look up at the sky and they go, wait a minute, why should I do what you're telling me to do? Because when emergencies end, populism always appears. Populism is when people trust themselves to take control of their lives, to make decisions for their families and their communities. In my view, this is the most powerful political force in the world today, and it's leading everywhere in the world, not just the United States, to lower tax rates, restoration of stable money, and a desire for freer trade. And this is extraordinarily good news for people everywhere in the United, everywhere in the world, as well as everywhere in the United States.
Right. And I want to focus on those tax cuts in a minute. But one of the things I want to, before we leave this other thing, this technology dividend, one of the things, see, I believe technology dividend is interwoven and supports and encourages the peace dividend.
Yes.
Because more and more people are communicating. I mean, I just got an email. Someone signed it for my newsletter this morning from London.
Yeah, this is...
The more we communicate with people, the more we interact with people in a... I mean, that was free. She signed it for my newsletter for free. I'll send it to her for free. It won't cost me anything from a standpoint of the transmission. Obviously, I have to take the time to create it. But basically, in terms of the old way of communicating with each other, that communication was basically free. When we can do that around the world with impunity, then that bolsters the peace dividend.
Absolutely, it's even more powerful than that, because we have the opportunity now to produce a new common sense of what it means to be human, and you know, this kind of a common sense operates all the time in the background. It shapes our whole view of the world, what we actually see. So let me tell you what I mean by that. In the early 20th century, sort of the common sense caricature of the human being was we were going to be connected to an assembly line, a la Henry Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Chaplin put out a movie called Modern Times, where people were all, you know, just nothing more than a cog in the wheel. With the invention of the mainframe computer, the common sense metaphor changed to that we were just part of a bigger social entity, and that Big Brother was going to rule our lives.
Chuck, I'm gonna have to interrupt you. Hold that thought. When we come back, I'll let you finish it. Folks, we've got to take a quick break. It's 20 after. We're going to let Chuck finish his thought on that. And then we're going to also talk about entrepreneurial politics, how that's changing the world. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. We are back. Charles W. Cadillac is managing director of J&W Seligman & Company. And in a minute, we're going to get him to tell us a little bit about his company. But he also has a book out that's been out for a few months. It's called Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction. And Chuck, you were just telling us. By the way, folks, if you want to call us, 888-822-8255. Chuck, you were finishing up a thought.
It's about the power of the Internet to change our common sense of what it means to be human. It's really a way of talking about how fundamental the technological revolution is. We're saying in the early 20th century, the metaphor was we're part of an assembly line. Starting in the 1960s, the invention of the mainframe computer, it was this notion we were part of just some greater society. There'd be a big brother telling everybody what to do, central control. But with the invention of the personal computer, reminded us of our autonomy. Everybody who got their first PC and had used a mainframe will remember how wonderful it was to have your own hard drive and your own operating system. But now, with the Internet, we realize that our full humanity, our full potential, is realized when we take this autonomous PC and we connect it to a network of human beings, ever-changing, ever-fluctuating, that's global in nature. It's an extraordinary thing.
Well, and if you look at what, in the past century, people who were outside of the United States dreamed of living in a democracy like the United States. Today, I believe more and more those same people who are disenfranchised in other parts of the world are dreaming not of our democracy, but of our entrepreneurial fertile soil over here. And we're able to export that via technology in a way that we never could have before.
Absolutely. In fact, what we see in many parts of the world is that economic freedom comes before political freedom.
That's right.
And in China today, think of where China is. If it wants to restrict the use of the Internet, then it forever will be out of the modern world. So it has to choose. It has to choose economic freedom versus being part of the world. And it's clear that the leaders of the Chinese government, as well as the Chinese people, want to be part of the modern world. inevitably they will have to yield to the internet. They can't have it both ways.
And fundamentally, if your country goes to war with another country, it's kind of important that your people, your citizens, sort of hate or don't like the people you're fighting. Well, how can a country convince their populace to hate a country that most of their populace are doing business with?
It makes it a whole lot more difficult. Both
to wage that war and support that war.
I just worry about theologies that conquer common sense.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing the internet is doing is the example you used. I have a wonderful little anecdote in the book to show the power of the internet to increase our prosperity. There's a couple in this little town in Wyoming, far away from Silicon Valley as you can get. And they had a convenience store. It went broke, so they took the inventory, put it in their garage, and one of the things they had to sell was a Santa Claus ornament with a propeller in its hat. And this was a small town in Wyoming, and not only could they not sell it, they couldn't give it away. No one in the town wanted one. So the husband said, hey, why don't we get up on one of these eBay kind of things on the internet and see if someone would like to buy it. So they posted it on one of these sites and set a minimum bid of $250. In 24 hours, they had an email from Italy bidding $7.50 and wondering if they had eight of them.
Wow.
In that moment, the standard of living of someone in Italy went up because they got an ornament they otherwise couldn't have gotten. They were better off. And the standard of living of these couple in Wyoming clearly went up. That's the magic mm-hmm. of the internet. It breaks the barriers of time and distance to trade. And any time we trade with other people, we always make both of us better off. That's why the trade occurs. And by multiplying our capacity to do that, the internet will profoundly increase not only our prosperity but our freedom. It's truly a historical shifting event, equivalent to the Industrial Revolution, equivalent to the invention of the movable type in the press.
No question. And I wrote an article about the new century of the entrepreneur for my newsletter back in the first of the year. And when I used, not unlike what you did, I compared the Mr. Ford's, Henry Ford's development of his empire. And the old leverage model for that entrepreneur was capital and facilities and staff, employees. And he had to have all of those in order to build his empire. Today, in my opinion, the three legs to what I'm calling the new leverage model for entrepreneurs is networking, strategic alliances, and technology.
Absolutely.
Stand by, Chuck. We're going to take a quick break, folks. It's 29 after. Chuck Cadillac is our guest. Charles W. Cadillac is what the name on the book. The book is Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction. It's available in bookstores. We're going to get him to tell us a little bit more about that when we come back. And we're going to move on into talking some more about the economy nationally and globally and the Federal Reserve Board and what they're up to. Stay with us. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate your business. Our phone number is 888-822-8255. If you'd like to join us, 1-888-822-8255. And don't forget to check out my website, www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. We've got some new stuff that's going up right now, even as we speak, and on through the next week or so. Just keep going back over the next few weeks. You're going to see some new stuff that I think will blow your doors away. And also, don't forget to sign up for my newsletter. Chuck Cadillac, Charles W. Cadillac, is our guest. He's the author of Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction. Chuck, tell us where the book's available, please.
It's available at all major bookstores, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, published by Prentice Hall.
Yeah, and check that out, folks. The last name is K-A-D. L-E-C, if you want to write that name into a search engine, one of the online bookstores, K-A-D-L-E-C, Charles W. Chuck, let's talk about, you used a term a minute ago that we don't use a lot on this show, only because I don't know much about it, but I want you to talk to us about price stability. You used that term a minute ago. What do you mean by that, and what does that mean for small business owners?
Well, price stability means that on average, prices are unchanged, or more modestly, historically, when the consumer price index is within a zone of plus or minus 2%, that is, it's not rising more than 2% or falling more than 2% in any one year. When prices are stable, it's easier to do business than when prices are highly volatile.
Notwithstanding petroleum prices, we've had price stability for some time, haven't we?
That's right, but see, price stability doesn't mean that all prices are stable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it allows for price of oil to go up, but it just means in a stable price environment, when one price, like oil, goes up, other prices have to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that a central bank, a good central bank, can in fact maintain price stability over very long periods of time, hundreds of years. Bank of England maintained price stability for 200 years during the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm. How'd they do it?
Well, what they did is they literally targeted the price level. They used as a proxy for the price level. See, this is the price level is an abstraction. To be operational, you have to say, well, this is what I mean by the price level. What the Bank of England said was going to be their proxy for the price level was the price of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the price of gold, while far from a perfect proxy of the price level, was actually pretty good. Pretty
mm-hmm.
good. So by stabilizing the price of gold, not the purchasing power of gold, but the nominal price of gold, what they did is they stabilized prices everywhere in the world that was using the British pound. It was
mm-hmm.
an extraordinary 200 years. And they did that, by the way, very simply. When the price of gold was going up, what that told them is there was too much money, so they shrank their balance sheet by selling treasury bills into the open market, the equivalent of treasury bills into the open market.
Mm-hmm.
And if the price of gold was falling, it said there was not enough money relative to demand for money, so they would supply more they'd expand their balance sheet by buying or discounting bills in the open market. So that's how they did it. They did it for 200 years without the benefit of computers or counting M1s or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's a modest claim, modest objective, but one that's extraordinarily powerful. So that's what I mean. An important thing here is that when prices are stable, it's easier to do business, so more business gets done. In fact, in the United States, since 1926, in the book we look at this, we take out the decade of the 40s just because it's dominated by World War II and a lot of things going on around World War II, military spending and the like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So from 1926 through 1998, excluding the 40s, when we have stable prices in the United States, CPI within the zone of plus or minus 2%, the average growth rate of the U.S. economy is 4.8% a year, nearly 5% a year. Those who say high growth causes inflation are wrong. They have it backwards. Stable prices permit high growth.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the longer the Federal Reserve maintains a stable price environment, the longer it's going to have to get used to all this growth that makes it uncomfortable.
But I see that's what's so bizarre and paradoxical is they're actually not comfortable with their good job.
Absolutely, and the words bizarre and paradoxical are exactly right. Because what they've done now is, if you look at Mr. Greenspan's latest testimony in front of the Congress, is Humphrey Hawkins' testimony. Instead of talking about targeting the price level, he's talking about targeting the rate of wealth creation in the United States and targeting the rate of unemployment rates in the United States. In fact, he's talking about the demand and supply for everything other than the demand and supply for money. Clearly, the Fed controls its balance sheet. That's what I mean by money. I don't mean M1 or all these other derivatives, but its balance sheet. It controls that, and it has influence over the demand for money, and clearly has the power to maintain at all times the balance between the supply and demand for dollars. If it does that, by definition, we would have a stable price environment. That is, overall prices would be stable. Some prices would go up, other prices would be going down, but on average, prices would remain unchanged.
But Chuck, I mean, we have Mr. Greenspan and his organization has just, they've just been outstanding, the things that they've done. I don't think you'd argue with that at all. Over the last 10 years or so, he's been outstanding. But it's almost like they've gotten it pretty much fixed, and they need to quit tinkering with it a little bit, to put it in a very elementary way.
Yeah, at the moment it's changed. I want to absolutely say what you just said. I have enormous respect for Paul Volcker, who is Mr. Greenspan's predecessor,
mm-hmm.
chairman of it, and Mr. Greenspan. They navigated from double-digit inflation to price stability without destroying our economy.
Mm-hmm.
We had to go through a lot of adjustments in those 15, 16 years. You can argue that a lot of discretion was necessary during that period of time. And I have enormous respect for their accomplishment. It's historic. But on the other hand, now that we've restored price stability, the CPI back under 2%, in 1998, and just over 2% in 99. The moment is different, the task is different, and the question is, can the Fed adapt?
We need new models, and I want you to talk to us about that when we come back. Folks, it's 39 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, a small business advocate. Charles W. Cadlick, author of Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction, is our guest. We'll be right back. I want to remind you, we're going to be having our home-based business hour coming up next, and that's going to be with Beverly Williams. After that, we're going to be talking to Joan Pride. She is senior editor with the Kiplinger Letters. We'll be talking about the most recent Kiplinger letter. David Losky on Friday to talk to us about what's been going on with the Microsoft case. He'll be giving us an update on that. And also after that, Mr. Crazy Floyd Hurt, will be joining us, and there's no telling what he'll be having on his mind, so looking forward to having him up. Chuck Kadlec, who is with Seligman and Company, J&W Seligman and Company out of New York City. Chuck, take a moment and tell us a little bit about your company.
Well, we manage about $40 billion in assets, both domestic and global international mutual funds. We're known best for our Communications and Information Fund, but we also have a growth fund, a value fund, small cap, mid cap funds, international funds, and the like.
And they can find your funds with their broker?
Yes, we choose actually to market our investment management only through financial advisors like brokers and or independent financial advisors.
Okay.
Because we think they play a vital role in helping people realize their financial goals. So that's where to find them.
Okay, and if they want to contact you online or in your offices, how would they do that?
Well, they should call at 212-850-1429.
What about the website? You got a website?
Oh, yeah. I have a Seligman has a website, although it's not email-enabled.
Okay.
And if they want to read just a summary of the book, they can. There is a website for the book called Dow100,000.com.
Dow100,000, that's the numbers, 100,000.
Yeah, the number 100,000, all one word,
.com,
and it provides a summary of the book.
And I know that you have gotten some good response. I know your book's in the top 100, I mean, the top 1,000, I should say, at Amazon right now. So that's pretty darn good high praise. And I know you've got some good comments about how user-friendly, how layperson-friendly your book is in understanding the economy.
Yes, I mean, it's the top 1,000 over 5 million books, so that's kind of give you an idea. I think the kind of feedback that I've gotten that makes really fills me with a sense of gratitude is when people tell me, you know, after reading your book, finally I can understand what the economic debate's all about. You were successful in tearing down all the jargon and stuff that economists use to bewilder and confuse, and they really say thank you for that. And second of all, they say, you know, finally I have a sense of what's possible, not that it's a sure thing, but also what to look out for, what could go wrong. So I feel in a better, much better position to put a strategy in place to arrange my financial affairs. And the last third of the book provides a couple of starting points to do that, to engage with a financial advisor and how to go about that.
That's great.
And then
that's a great resource.
Finally, people say, you know what, it's also just a wonderful story about human beings and about the future that we can produce. And it's up to us. You know, we are going to produce the future. It's not given to us by any external force. And that really captures, I think, the whole mood and the adventure of the book. So I had a lot of fun writing it, and I'm just thrilled when people, you know, come back today, how much they enjoyed it.
Well, and it helps you navigate, folks, the challenges and the opportunities that's coming around the corner. Chuck, let's get back into our discussion about the new models. We were talking about the Fed, and as you know, we're going to have the president of the Dallas Bank on the show next week, and he's been on before, and I'm working up my nerve to invite the chairman. I doubt if he'll come, but you know what? I will be giving him an opportunity to join me. He can always say no, but I don't have a problem asking people. But anyway, we're going to have Bob McTeer on next Wednesday, and he's going to be talking to us. If he were here right now, what would you like to say to him?
Well, I would like to ask him why interest rates in the United States are so high. They're the highest in the industrialized world. Interest rates in Italy and Spain and Portugal and Singapore are below where they are in the United States. And I'd like to know why.
Now, you know, one of their arguments is going to be interest rates are below a point in Japan, and yet their economy is still not great. So lowering rates are not necessarily the key. That's what they're going to, argument.
Yeah, but that's answering a different question. I just want to know why are interest rates so high, because if you look at, we have budget surpluses, we're at peace. In the United States, normally in these conditions, interest rates, long-term interest rates are below 5%. Today they're above 6%. And that's you know, we should have 30-year fixed mortgages again below 5% like we did in the 1960s. There's no reason not to have them.
And why wouldn't that? I mean, that would definitely spur the economy. What's wrong with that? If they're looking around and productivity is keeping inflation in check, and as you say, we've got world peace, we've got all this new capability coming online that's creating a lot of the wealth, what's wrong with that?
Well, one of the answers back is that, well, the reason interest rates are so high is because the real returns on capital are so high. This is a rather sophisticated argument, and there may be some truth in that. But I would then say, but wait a minute, are you telling me that the rates of return on capital today are higher than they were in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s when we were developing the West? Imagine the return on capital when we had all this unused land.
Mm-hmm.
Or how about the 1920s? we had an extraordinary stock market and incredible advances in the Industrial Revolution. And we had falling prices on average during the 20s, and we had much lower interest rates than we do today. Or the 50s and 60s, after World War II, are you saying that the returns on capital as we redeveloped Japan and Europe were that much higher than they are today? I mean, I find that to be a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one thing. And the second thing I would say is, it seems to me that the Fed has to do three basic things. One is identify what it means by the price level. What is it? Are you going to use the price of a basket of commodities? Are you going to use the CPI? Tell us what it is, and then commit to some action. Are you going to maintain the CPI below 2% or whatever? And then finally, how are you going to do that?
Well,
in a way that's believable. If the Fed were to do those things, those three things, I believe interest rates would go back below 5%. They always have been there historically.
Stand by, Chuck. We got to take a quick break, folks. 50 after. We'll be right back with our good friend Chuck Cadlick. He's the author of Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction. Stay with us. Thank you very much for joining us. And we're visiting with our good friend Chuck Cadlick. Charles W. Cadlick is the author of Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction. His last name is spelled Kadlec. When you type that name into the search engine of your online bookstores, or when you look for it in the bookstores, Dow 100,000, Fact or Fiction. Check it out. I'm sure you'll be pleased with your purchase. Chuck, I said something a minute ago. I asked you, what would you say to Bob McTeer, who's the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank, and last year was a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee, but this year, 2000, is not a voting member, although he sits in on the FOMC meetings and gets to make his comments. Every member of the FOMC, all 17, get to stand up and say something, as he explained to us last time, but he doesn't get to vote. Five of them don't get to vote. Only 12 get to vote. Now, But one of the things we know about Bob McTeer is that he's one of the mavericks. In fact, last summer, when the Fed raised rates twice, he was the only dissenting vote to raise rates of all of 12. Now, so he's a little bit of a fellow traveler with you and me, with most of us. So let's direct our question now to Mr. Greenspan, who's probably got a lot more influence. What would you be telling him to look at? What should he be looking at? What new model should he be focusing on?
Well, I think there's two things that he needs to do. One is he needs to start talking about what the Fed can do, which is to balance the demand and supply for money. It's totally absent from all of his testimony. It's a glaring absence.
And isn't that their prime directive, really?
It is their prime directive. And by money, I don't mean the M1s, M2s, M3s, and all that. I mean the monetary base, the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. It has absolute total control over the rate of growth of its balance sheet. That is a fundamental supply of money, and it can always bring that into balance with the demand for money by targeting the price level. And if the price level begins to fall, they simply expand their balance sheet. The price level begins to rise, inflation, they begin to contract their balance sheet, or at least have it grow more slowly.
But the Fed is monkeying with a lot more things than that.
Right. And that's the second point I would say, is that we need now that we're back to price stability, that we've made it through this transition where we needed a lot of discretion, or arguably needed a lot of discretion, it's time now for us to put in place a process that is part of the Fed, that doesn't depend on a single man or woman like Paul Volcker or Alan Greenspan. I mean, we are one heartbeat away from a potential disaster because no one actually knows how Alan Greenspan figures out what to do next. I mean, this is kind of their best guess at the time.
And he is basically deified in that organization.
Right, and for me, the greatest legacy that Alan Greenspan could leave now is to create, it's a big word, with institutionalization, he could create a process that he could leave behind so that everybody in the world, not only in America, could believe that price stability would persist after the end of this term.
So he becomes more of a manager instead of a king.
Yeah, it's not as deified, but let me tell you, from a historical perspective, it's the single greatest achievement, single greatest legacy he could have, is to put back in place a monetary standard for the U.S. dollar that would bring interest rates down and give everybody the confidence that price stability would persist well beyond his term, maybe for two or three generations, in fact.
What a legacy that would be.
That's what I would ask Mr. Greenspan to do, is to find a way to do that in the next 4 years. He has the credibility in Capitol Hill. He has the credibility among the American people. He has the skill to do it. All that's needed now is the will and the leadership to abandon the tinkering model the management model of the economy and instead move to the legacy model, which says I need to leave something behind that transcends any one personality. We need to move beyond the rule of men and women, as capable as they are, back to the rule of law.
Chuck, that's got to be the last word. That was excellent. Thank you very much. Chuck Cadillac, ladies and gentlemen, with Seligman and Company, author of Dow 100,000 Factor Fiction. Chuck, we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Jim.
Good job.
Thank you.
Got to go, folks. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest entrepreneurial country in the world. And remember, if it is to be, it is up to me. This is Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.